Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here's your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University, and back by popular demand, Resistance Radio, the summer edition of Resistance Radio, with my pals Professor Ben McGraw at Penn State University and Professor Jim Brosnan at the University of Tennessee. Last time we got together, we started, of course, with all good conversations with the three of us. I should say one normal sports fan and two degenerate New England sports fans. And we started out with conversations about all those winning teams you had. And I just wanted to start out by, drawing your attention to who is in fact in first place in the Eastern Division as we enter the dog days of summer here in June pretty soon. I'm looking at stats, and all I want to do is throw around stats with you guys. And I noticed something as I'm looking at my At-Bat app, fellas. I'm looking at this, and I'm seeing all the different team stats. And, of course, one of the stats that Boston is at the top of is number of errors, which, of course, I was very happy to see. Not surprised. And I also was interested to see the number of home runs is almost at the bottom of the American League. And that must mean you missed that big poppy a little bit. So let me start not with a question about the Red Sox, but to you, Jim Brosnan. What do you make of all this data, right? I just spouted off a little bit of data. And I want to just have a little conversation about how data is starting to impact the things that we're doing. And you in the weed world, you in the resistance world, you in the, predicting emergence world, how's data going to change the things that you think about doing every day? And of course, you can throw in a Red Sox comment if you want. I know you probably have a hat on as we speak.
Well, sure. And thanks for having me again, Frank. I mean, I figured when I had sat down with you and thought to do this again for a summer edition, there'd be a good 25 or 30 minutes of Aaron Judge talk. So if you want to go off on that tangent, we can do that. But you do raise a good point with your comments about data. Certainly the seam heads in baseball have been tracking analytics data for a long, long time, and I think you can overuse it in baseball to a degree. I remember the year the Red Sox went closer by committee because Bill James figured out that the seventh inning was more important than the ninth inning, and that didn't get them where they wanted to be at the end of the year. But circling back to weed science wise, I do think that data are becoming, the ability to track data on a large scale are becoming more important. I was just recently at the Global Herbicide Resistance Conference in Denver, and there were sessions tailored mainly towards agronomic cropping systems, though, looking at data acquisition devices on spray rates, treating, hundreds and hundreds of acres, and are there things that could be tracked with that data in order to make weed management more precise? And the thought with that came out of a conversation about the Environmental Protection Agency and thinking that if we could move towards precision weed management where active ingredient is being targeted towards maybe even a single plant or certainly a smaller percentage of the total acreage of area that might be treated, maybe that would allow for some different actives to get through registration because the pounds on the ground would be less, so to speak.
Okay, so let me interrupt you there, Jim, because first of all, and Ben, I don't know if you heard it. Did our pal just say he went to a global weed conference in Denver?
Yeah, I guess
that would be correct.
I tuned out.
Okay, so there's the question and the transfer to you. Certainly, as Jim said, Ben, sort of precision applications. And I know too, he's involved in this, you're involved in the regional PGR project that I think is striving to bring more data-driven applications to the use of plant growth regulators. Is that a fair assessment of that regional work you're working on?
Yeah, we have, that is a fair assessment, and it's much needed here in the South with PGR applications to warm season putting greens. We've seen, let's call it abuse of the product labels for particularly Trinexapac ethyl, with applications going out on far too frequent of intervals where overregulation is becoming problematic and there's kind of a cascade of issues that comes along with that. So Dr. Bill Kreiser, who you know well, at the University of Nebraska, pioneered this effort to take a more precise approach to PGR use on bentgrass and has worked collaboratively with several scientists in the South now to get more of a regional look at PGR use on ultra-growth Bermuda grass greens. And we're certainly excited for the project to start.
So, and we all are too, because listen, the more precise we can be, whether it's treating weeds or treating to manage growth, and I think there's a strong interaction there with mowing height is something I think they're finding already. But let's get to you, Professor McGraw. Certainly data-driven applications is the world of annual bluegrass weevil. You had developed a really successful approach in social media for making people aware of what you're seeing. And I think, you know, between you and Steve McDonald, by following you two guys with the occasional timely tweet that you make that informs us about the data, I think it's getting us better. So beyond that, Ben, is the data that we talked about earlier, the last time we were together about the data, about the behavior of golf course superintendents and the way they treat weevils. The data from that obviously is going to impact the way we think about things. How is data, breaking into the insect world? Is it the scouting and resistance things we're talking about, or is there more?
Oh, I think we're definitely entering a new era as far as insect management and using data. Whether that's, following something like Weevil Track, which is Syngenta's proprietary monitoring website, or it's people using check plots on the golf course, I really think we're moving from kind of an anecdotal to more science-driven management of insects on golf courses, which is a positive thing. The difficult thing, if you think about like Jim's world versus my world, it's really easy to see control and really easy to determine percent control when you're dealing with weeds. With insects, and a lot of our below ground feeders, it's really challenging to know exactly whether or not the product that you put down actually controlled the insect or whether it was just that they weren't present, because they don't occur uniformly over a site that something like a disease or a weed would do. So I think data is everything. I think it's a little bit challenging to acquire that data in the insect world, but I do think that we are moving to a better place.
And so let me move to some weaving of New England sports and data, because obviously the Red Sox are known for this. But I got to tell you, I have towards the end of the season, I find most of the basketball season a colossal waste of time personally. I'm not a big basketball fan, but did it really take them 8 months to find these two teams? So let's go back to what I did learn. And that is that kid that coaches for the Celtics is pretty good. Do you either of you guys know if he's a data guy? What is he doing to make what looks like a team of sort of, I don't know, wouldn't call them stars by any measure, and that point guard you can barely see in amongst the Giants out there. What do you guys want to tell me about what this Celtics coach is doing?
Yeah,
I think NBA basketball is unwatchable, so I'm going to defer to Jim on this one.
Yeah, I would second that in large part. I mean, I'll admit I did watch some of the playoffs and rode the bandwagon pretty hard because, the Bruins checking out in round one upped my free time quotient.
Definitely.
So, yeah. One of the things I think Stevens is really good at is it seems it's amazing how they can come out of a timeout and run a play that almost immediately scores. That was one thing I noticed as an uneducated basketball fan watching the playoffs. Towards the data end of it, though, I think a lot of that credit should go to Danny Ainge, just kind of revamping that team as the league has changed. You look at NBA games now, and it's a three-point shooting league more than ever before, and There's not a whole lot of big men like there were in the late 80s and early 90s. And the Celtics kind of show that. They've got a lot of quick, smaller, quick guys that can shoot. And that's kind of propelled them forward.
And so as we wrap up this opening segment where we've wandered into New England sports, where would I be without asking the question, if Brady didn't get those concussions playing football, what the hell is Giselle doing to him when nobody's looking? Because apparently he's got some concussions that your beloved Patriots didn't know anything about. Would either one of you care to comment on the, 50 Shades of Darker that's going on in the Brady Bunchen house?
Yeah, I think that's a case of a wife wanting her husband to retire.
Do you think our women would go to bat for us like that, fellas?
Possibly.
It's up for question. Okay.
If turf grass professors were compensated like NFL yes. starting quarterbacks, maybe.
you think we could make it as underwear models, the three of us? You think there's hope for us as underwear models?
Definitely.
Okay, all right. Well, we have wandered into the abyss in this conversation. When we come back, I want to get back to some conversations that include things like synchronicity and phrase mowing. This is Frank Rossi. I'm Frankly Speaking with Professor Ben McGraw and Jim Brosnan. We'll be right back.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University with Professor Ben McGraw from Penn State, Jim Brosnan, the professor of weed science at the University of Tennessee. We wandered into New England sports, and of course, that got us nowhere. So if there's anybody left listening to this podcast, maybe they're going to be interested in the next couple of topics. And Ben, I want to start with you, because every year in the Northeast and much of the northern areas, particularly where this stem-feeding weevil known as the annual bluegrass weevil becomes the major pest problem in our area, the timing of application becomes really critical. One of the things I saw you tweet this year was that when you looked at the larvae, it looked like there was pretty good uniformity in sizes. I wrote about this and called it synchronicity in a little blog post. Is it happening? How can you explain it based on the funky, wet, hot days, cool days? It's hard to see. It doesn't feel like biological populations should be synchronous with the crazy weather we've been having. Is it happening in ABW, and what's going on there?
I will say yes and no, but before I get into that, I totally forgot to thank you for letting me be a part of an earlier broadcast that I believe was the most cited, or at least the best listened to podcast in Frankly history.
That's right. That's right. And that's why you're back for part two.
I think I heard from most of the 35 individuals who listened to that. And I appreciate you bringing us back for ratings week as well. I didn't know that podcasts had ratings weeks, but I'm happy to help you in any way, Frank.
I'm totally desperate. We're shilling for anybody to buy this damn program. You think Blue Apron will sponsor us?
I don't even know what that is.
A better way to turf.
All right, but, so APW.
Yeah, synchronicity. So yes and no. So I will say that there's a couple of factors that really affect synchronicity. You talked about weather. But once we move into the season and people start putting management plans into effect, something that's been rather controversial, which kind of loops back to what we're talking about here with the resistance, is the use of an adulticide. And the courses that I've worked with recently, especially the ones in western Pennsylvania, it might have been weather that was driving kind of a very synchronized flush, but it's also what superintendents did if they followed my recommendations at that time, and the couple of courses that I consult with out there did, and they made a really one rather than several, but one really well-timed adulticide. And what that does, and why I've always, I've still continued to promote the use of a sensible adulticide, is it really narrows down your adult population so that they're laying eggs all in a very confined window. And populations that did that, you know, there are going to be some that get by that are not killed for whatever reason. There's still going to be some adults that might be late emergers from overwintering sites that are going to lay eggs. So we expect to see larvae even in places that we've treated with an adulticide. But what it does is it really kind of corrals the larval stages all around, you know, one or two instars. So, and that's what we've seen the last couple of weeks out in western Pennsylvania in these treated areas. Now, fast forward to today, and we pulled some samples from our central Pennsylvania site. I would say there's a pretty good fluctuation in temperature there. Pittsburgh seems to be a little bit warmer than our central PA site, but our central Pennsylvania site also dips down a little bit cooler, and that might have held a few adults in overwintering sites longer, or once they were out on the surface, kind of hunkered down. And also we're dealing with much larger untreated areas because that's where we're putting out a lot of our trials. So what we saw there today was much bigger spread, but the amount of untreated turf around those areas where we're pulling those cores from probably harbored a lot of adults for a long period of time. So rather than ratcheting down those populations. So in the most part, I think it's kind of twofold. It's weather plus management that really leads to that synchronicity.
So if you make that adulticide, are you lowering the population? Let's assume it's a well-timed, a single reasonable adulticide, and that we don't have extremely high levels of resistance in the population. Assuming though both those things are true, could a single well-timed adulticide reduce the egg laying enough that even if they go through it, you're not going to get intense injury? Because I'm assuming by narrowing the window to making them all the same phase, won't that make them all feed at the same time as well? And couldn't that make the injury more intense?
I would say definitely. And I think that is, let's just say you, in some ideal situation for an entomologist, less ideal for a superintendent, you had all the adults emerge at one time. What we know is it's more like a normal distribution where you have some early arrivers, the majority come through in the middle, and then you have some stragglers. But if they all came through at the same time, all dropped their eggs at the same time, and had a super synchronous larval population, you would expect that the larval feeding damage would be very intense, and damage would be very intense. So that is kind of the downside of synchronicity. But the idea of making the adulticide is narrowing that down, but you're also dropping the population. You know, you're killing potential egg layers.
Okay. All right. Well, so let me leave you there for a second. Go to our weed pal, Jim. In the crabgrass world, right, when I'm listening to Ben talk about the distribution of the way the insects move in and out, I remember, I think it was actually the fairy ring man himself, Mike Fidanza, who did some work with Dernodin years ago, looking at degree days of when populations emerge. And I think he did say there's like 25% in, you know, early, and then there's this big slug of 50%, and then there's this last 25% that'll germinate later, but maybe not produce viable seed. You want to talk a little bit about, let's just take crabgrass, goosegrass, or annual grass emergence. Do we know the same thing for the way that infests, or have we really never paid attention to it because everybody puts pre's down and nobody cares?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that. I mean, we definitely know that we have variable flushes throughout a season. We don't have the synchronicity that you guys were referring to earlier. And that causes a lot of problems. You know, take this past poa season, for example. you know, conditions were so dry throughout a major portion of the Southeast that if you put out a well-timed pre at a calendar date that was historically when you should be doing that, some of the products didn't really hold up real well because we didn't get our first major flush of annual bluegrass until probably late November or early December, which was months later. So you really needed to have something down with extended residual to get you where you wanted to be. And that posed some problems with other traditional treatments that had worked well, you know, early post applications on POA, things like simazine, for example, or maybe a monument application in the fall, something that even in our trial work at multiple locations for the past two or three years had done excellent. Those programs really failed by and large this year because the germination flush was so different and from what it had been in previous years. So it's definitely an area where we need more work on in the weed science world, because a lot of those growing degree day models, you know, the Crabgrass one that Mike built, and there are several others out there, we have found that there can be some regional variability to that.
Well, and for sure, I'm sure both of you would agree, as we go to our second break, I'm sure both of you would agree that the freaky climate is making things very difficult to do. You know, we just cleared up 4 or 5 years of drought persistence in the last 3 months throughout much of the continental United States. And at the same time, are coming off our second straight warm winter in a row. And I'm wondering if the whole season isn't start to shifting later, that our falls are longer and the springs seem to consistently take a little longer to arrive. So I guess, you know, as we go to break, both of those things become very critical in managing your pest populations, would be them insects or weeds, that if you're going to use models or you're going to try to predict, there's nothing that's going to replace for really scouting. I mean, obviously, Ben, that's true for you. People are clearly looking for these insects, yes? Ben? All right, we lost Ben. I don't know. Ben, you okay? Maybe he's got the mute button on and doesn't know it. Jim, with that as a backdrop, nothing's really replacing going out and looking for weeds, right? I mean, you still got to look, or are we not do that?
No, for sure. Nothing's going to replace scouting. And, you know, the dynamic you talked about with changing climate is certainly true with our weed models. You know, there's some models out there that try to time when you can make, say, a Ronstar application in the spring, because that usually has to go out to dormant turf or close to that, or non-selective herbicide applications in the spring, whether they be Roundup or Finale or Reward. And we don't really want to have green tissue when those applications are made. And there's been efforts made by several scientists to develop some models to try to predict when's the latest that you could do this. But all of those models assume you start the year with completely dormant turf with no green cover. And that was not the case in Tennessee this year. You know, we had, we had Bermuda grass with green tissue, you know, Christmas Day.
Okay. Well, that's the crazy thing about how the climate is going. The warm season grasses are moving further north, right? The better they're able to survive that cold temperature, the more we're going to see them be more successful. So we'll be right back with Professor Brosnan and Professor McGraw. This is Frankly Speaking.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Jim Brosnan and Ben McGraw. We have made it through New England sports. We have made it through some conversations about current issues in pest control and resistance and, you know, figuring out when to implement a strategy based on trying to predict either germination or adult populations or larvae. And now I want to wander into something that is, one of them is very current that I'm growing fatigued with, and one of them is, I think, an emerging technology. And Jim, let me start with you. Back in 2006, when I took my sabbatic in Scandinavia, Denmark in particular had been a country that had pesticides and herbicides in particular banned for more than 15 years. And they were having these hellacious weed problems in their golf course roughs and on many of their sports fields. On the sports fields, it was almost exclusively annual bluegrass. When you went to the golf course roughs, as of course you might imagine, without regular mowing, it was a lot of fescue, but of course a lot of other weeds had invaded as well. And what I observed them doing was coming along with what looked like a milling machine, and it was apparently a machine developed by the Dutch called the Coral Field Top Maker. And they came along and just milled off the surface, went back and seeded really heavy, and got about 5 to 7 years out of either a ryegrass fairway or a fescue rough before they had to go back and the weed population was so severe, they would just go in and do the same thing again. We call this now phrase mowing. I think that's a word from metallurgy that they use to mill off metal. I believe you've been playing around with this. I bought a machine back in 2007 from Steck down in South Carolina called the GBK thing, whatever it is now. And I'm wondering what you can tell me about phrase mowing, and I'm particularly interested in, do you think it's possible to just pull the damn weed seeds out of there?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up, you know, in an effort, because Ben and I had a deal before we started that we would talk New England sports in every segment. So, you know, it should remind you in a conversation about POA that we're about 98 days away from the Patriots hanging another championship banner. So make sure you've got your DVR set, Frank. I know you don't want to miss it.
Well, I only want to be sure if Roger Goodell is there. You think he'll be there?
He says he will be. I don't know. I don't know if I believe him, but he says he will be. Anyway,
so 98 days. I just want to be sure it's 98 days because I'll have to set my DVR.
Do you even have a team, yeah. Frank? Are there any any teams that you root for in the NFL?
I will root for the Green Bay Packers, and I root for every team that plays against the Patriots.
Wow, spoken like a true New Yorker.
That's right. All right, Jim, phrase mowing, pal.
All right. So, you know, my introduction to the unit is pretty similar to yours. I was lucky enough to visit the All England Lawn and Tennis Club a few years ago and really was curious about what their POA management program would be, thinking they would have an elaborate PGR, herbicide, nutritional program to manage POA on those playing surfaces. And in talking to Neil Stubley and the crew there, it became really kind of amazing that the courts were devoid of POA to speak of. And all they really did was this phrase mowing technology where they would come in, as you described, and mill off the, you know, top of the playing surface and then reestablish new ryegrass. So as resistance cases kind of worsened here in the South, and you read in the crops literature about harvest weed seed control and some of these mechanical implementations that are coming along with spraying to manage weeds, kind of got the idea with some colleagues to look further into this. So we just finished a 2-year project with summer phrase mowing of warm season turf. So letting that recover and then looking at what that does to annual bluegrass infestation the following winter. And what we've seen has been pretty interesting. I mean, we've got this is in zoysia grass maintained as a fairway now, about 8 weeks to get full recovery after a June phrase mowing. In Bermuda grass, that tends to be a touch faster than zoysia just on the nature of the species. And we're seeing 35 to 40% reductions in annual bluegrass counts. Now, by no means perfect, you're not going to get 100% annual bluegrass control with a single phrase mowing event. But certainly you're reducing the overall population by doing this. And I think much is the case in the crops world, the integration of a mechanical technique with maybe a traditional spray program and a well thought out spray program from a rotation or mixture standpoint is probably where phrase mowing is going to fit in.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly what I'm wondering about. And when you did that work, did you do different depths? And if you did you count weed seeds, or how are you approaching figuring out if the weed population or the weed sink bank has been reduced, or you guys didn't approach it like that yet?
That's a great question. No, the way that we did it in terms of a depth standpoint was we went for maximum depth, trying to get at, there's a paper published by Bruce Branham, I believe, in the early 2000s that looks at where the 80%, I believe, of the viable annual bluegrass seed is in the top 1 centimeter of soil. Of the soil profile. So we went and tried to remove deeper than that. I believe our target was 1.25 inches, 1.25 centimeters of the soil profile, and that, which was very aggressive. And we would phrase mow that off, remove the debris, let the turf heal. And then in terms of looking at annual bluegrass plants, what we would do is then come in with a grid and basically do grid counts of annual bluegrass plants per plot the following winter. We also wanted to kind of get after a mass balance approach, if you will. So after everything had healed, and you can think about, we've got plots that had been phrase mowed and then had not been phrase mowed, we would harvest cores from the center of those plots, and we've sent them to Dr. Aaron Patton at Purdue. And he has a fairly extensive assay to germinate weed seed in soil. And we're basically putting these soil cores through a vernalization period, if you will, so we can vernalize the seed, and then trying to exhaust the weed seed that's in them. And we've both been very surprised at how many germination cycles we've needed to exhaust these soils to completion. So we're not only looking at annual bluegrass, but we're getting at other weeds as well, you know, summer annual weeds and winter annual weeds, both grasses and broadleaves. So it'll end up being a really robust data set when it's finished.
This is great. And we're going to, just so you know, before I get to our entomology friend, we're starting a similar project on a sports field here in upstate New York and out in the Vineyard Club, Martha's Vineyard, which, you know, he's a degenerate Patriot fan himself. Speaking of that, Jeff Carlson is a complete degenerate. And they are funding a graduate student with us to study organic weed control. And to your point, I basically am approaching the phrase mowing as a mechanical means of doing it. And we want to approach it the same way you did, looking at the weed population to know, you know, how long you got to do this. Now, in our case, Jim, we're going to try and seed really heavy into it. That is the big difference, right? You're relying on the warm season grass to recover. I'm trying to see if I can get the existing turf there to recover and then interseed enough new aggressive varieties to maybe keep the weeds at bay longer. Your last comment of the day, you think that's going to work?
Yeah, I actually think it might even be more successful than what we see in the warm season end of things when you draw the parallels to what's done in Europe with the instrument. You know, from what we saw in a 2-year project, you would get a 35-ish% reduction in annual bluegrass after 1 year of phrase mowing. But then if you went back and looked at that plot the second year where it got phrase mowed in year one and no phrase mowing in year two, it wasn't really different from a non-treated. And that speaks to recruitment of annual bluegrass seed, maybe from surrounding areas, or you know, you think about at a research plot setting, the same mower is going to be mowing the entire block and the study didn't take the entire space of that block. So recruitment of new annual bluegrass seed into our system, I think could explain the transient effect that we saw from year to year. So we have a lot more to learn about how to implement this on a larger scale. This was kind of a first look to prove the concept in the warm season world, but I'll be interested to learn how your project at the Vineyard Club turns out.
Well, and we are allotting some funds for weed scientists who are not degenerate New England fans to maybe come out. So maybe we'll get our pal Aaron Patton, who I might like more than you, if I got to put up with two Patriot fans in person with you and Carlson. It's tough enough with you and McGraw on the radio. And so as much as I could keep talking about phrase mowing, because I'm so excited about it, I have to tell you, Professor McGraw, I'm beginning to get pollinator fatigue. Now, I'm very fond. You would say I'm as fond of pollinators as the next guy, maybe even more so. And I know this is important stuff. I got to tell you, I'm tongue in cheek on this a little bit, but to a certain extent, I think we run the risk soon of our industry. Hopefully it's going to be ingrained in our culture, but do you share my fatigue, and do you think we've got the message across to these turf managers? Because while I might be fatigued, there probably are still maybe 20 to 40% of our population of insecticide users in turf who might not entirely read the label all the time.
Oh, sure. I mean, think about how frequently you apply something that you regularly apply, and how often do you go to the label for that. So I think there, you know, especially in golf turf world where you're applying fungicides on an annual basis that you applied in years before, of course you're not going to go back to read the label. You're already familiar with it, but there's a lot of important information in there. And there's a lot of new information too as far as taking care of pollinators, but I totally hear you from pollinator fatigue syndrome. I think that's a real thing that's happening. You know, being here at Penn State, we have probably the top honeybee group in the nation, and they bring in tons and tons of money. So I think what many of your listeners might not realize is that the three of us have to actively go out and seek money to fund research that we want to do, and to fund our staff, and to find students and fund our students as well. And then when we come to the end and we finish our research, we then have to pay for it to be published. So that might be something that people don't know. And our federal government, for better or for worse, has decided to throw a lot of money at these pollinator issues. So, and my sources say that there's really no end in sight of the funding for that. So it is a very important, research problem to be working on. It definitely affects global food supply. Mm-hmm. But
No one's arguing that they're certainly not important, right? I mean, we certainly like our pollinated crops, and
exactly,
and for as best as we can understand how our ecosystems function, we certainly want to have these pollinators as part of our ecosystems. How worried? Let me change the subject for a second. Maybe I have fatigue because I wonder how worried we have to be. I do think golf courses can be enormously exceptional places for habitat where they're not regularly using insecticides, or to be honest, I think we're pretty clear just about everything that we leave on the foliage could potentially impact the pollinators. So how worried are you on a scale of 1 to 10 that our day-to-day activities of spraying are putting the pollinators at risk, particularly on golf courses?
1 to 10, I would say maybe 3 or 4.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
so
I think
enough that it's on the radar, but not enough that you're just afraid to step out of the house.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely legitimate concerns. There are definitely, things that you can do to, reduce the risk to pollinators for sure. I think, you know, because that's where a lot of funding is, some of my colleagues are starting to look in those areas and see the impacts about, you know, what are bees doing in, or not just bees, but other pollinators doing in these spaces that typically aren't putting off a sugary nectar reward. I had a phone call from an individual in Canada the other day who said that bees are pollinating turf grasses, that he never knew that. I question that. I don't think, and you, Frank, would know better than I about how grasses mix. I would imagine that it's more wind dispersed, if anything, and not.
It's my understanding it's wind dispersed. I don't see a lot of foraging bees.
Yeah, I think that's the anecdotal evidence that we often run into in our line of work, that somebody sees something and it's not based on empirical evidence. They're resting on turf grass plants. I think they probably might feed on guttation fluid. I kind of don't think that they'd be really overly active in the morning when that's being produced. But there are possible routes of entry that could bring something into contact with a pollinator. Many of the products that we use, we don't know the full effect of the inert ingredients, all the non-reactive ingredients that go into making a pesticide more dispersible or spreadable or stickable. So there are definitely lots and lots of things that need to be worked on. But, you know, part of my rating of a 3 or less concerned end of the scale is really because there aren't a whole lot of flowering sources that would be great for something like a bumblebee or a honeybee to go out and forage on, with the exception of white clover. I mean, white clover is pretty ubiquitous in most turfgrass situations. So,
I guess what I'm worried about with the fatigue is, if we're going to apply pesticides, there are some really simple steps. Like, if you have granular insecticide options, or if you're going to water it in, that you water it in right away. If you have to apply near flowers, near tee boxes or near clubhouses, that you maintain a bit of a buffer. I want to make sure that whoever's listening, you know, the two people left that are probably me and you two and two other guys that are left listening, you know, my sense is that I worried as really just a few simple things most of these guys have to do to solve 95% of the risk issues that they might confront. And I'm worried that people are going to make this really complicated, and maybe that's the source of some of my fatigue.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you on doing those simple things. And what I would caution, though, is those are simple things that we know about with interactions with insecticides. There's a huge dearth of information as far as fungicides or, you know, any other herbicides. But typically we think of those as being less harmful because they don't work on the insect's nervous system. It could potentially have some issues, sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we didn't really get to a lot of resistance conversation about where we were talking about our resistant materials. And I did, we did the last time, Mr. Brosnan, promote your POA days on Facebook Live. How about a comment? How did that delivery mechanism go before we get you out of here?
It went great. And if there's anybody listening that, you know, watched it live on Facebook or watched it after the fact, uploaded to Vimeo, I'd love to hear from you on what, you know, what went well and what went poorly. We've gotten some really good feedback already with almost 600 views of the content, which is, you know, more than 10x what we would have had if we had an in-person field day. Some really good feedback about ways to tailor things to make it better suited for video in terms of how we sign plots and making the treatment lists available online beforehand. So we're definitely excited to do it again next year and hopefully grow it beyond that 600 to get more people in tune with this conversation about resistance management and POA. And, you know, I think that there's room to do it for other weeds as well. You know, one of the take-homes I had from this herbicide resistance meeting I was at a few weeks ago.
Out in Denver.
The ag guys talked a lot about how, you know, we have these conversations about resistance and we kind of talk to ourselves or amongst ourselves. And what we really need to do to change use is find the end user. So for us, that would be the golf course superintendent or the turf manager, to champion the cause and get the end user talking about resistance and what they're doing to manage resistance and speaking to other end users about it. And that paradigm shift can really help change practice. The Australians had done that there with their resistance problems in ag, and it seemed to have really helped them move forward. And I think we're certainly an opportunity to do that in turf.
Well, And that's an excellent final word. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedules and putting up with me for about 40, 45 minutes here. It's much appreciated. And I guess based on what Mr. Brosnan has told us, Professor McGraw, that we'll be together in about 90-something days because I'm going to have to listen to the abuse for when the banner gets hung. Are you going to buy a newspaper for the banner being hung, Jim, or do you save that just for when they win?
You just save that for when they win. But who knows? I mean, you know, after the All-Star break, Red Sox rotation could heat up here, and, you know, Aaron Judge might remember that he's Aaron Judge, and things could switch out.
Well, we're looking forward to them coming into town next week. I actually will be there Thursday night, so I'll be urinating on the bus that they pull up with when they get there. So just to christen it to give them good luck. Fellas, thanks for joining me. This is Resistance Radio, the summer edition with Professor Jim Brosnan at the University of Tennessee and Professor Ben McGraw at Penn State University. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University. This is Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.